What a wild year of MotoGP it's been so far.
Wait, Dre, what do you it's mean? Just February.
Ah, about that. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. Just one nonsense-free day, that's all we ask for on this pod, and yet here we are. Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 637 of Motorsport 101. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Glad you could join us. Hope you guys are having a good January, or technically it's now February by the time this goes out. It's been a little while since we've done one of these. It's been about a week and a half, and I'm kind of glad we recorded this on Sunday, because if we recorded this at our usual slot, we would have missed all hell breaking loose. If anyone's ever seen Doctor Who in the end of time towards David Tennant's run, when Gallifrey suddenly rolls up, and then the Doctor looks at this family and he goes, "Hell is descending." That's what this feels like. It's been an absolutely wacky 48 hours in the world of motorsport to go alongside what was a pretty riveting Rolex 24 Hours of Daytona in many different ways. So for the next 90 minutes or so, we're going to try and make sense of all of it here on this here podcast. But first of all, let me introduce my guests real quick. First up, he's returned home after a very busy couple of weeks over there in Florida. Mr. RJ O'Connell, how was it, my friend?
Rolex 24 this year was very fascinating. We'll talk about that later in the show. What I was not expecting when I was packing my clothes and planning to go through testing and the days in between and everything building up to the race and then the race itself, what I was not expecting was to come home to the remnants of the blizzard of the decade in the eastern United States, which is how I came home a day later than I had wanted to, which is how I missed the opportunity to go to a sports event the day after I was supposed to return. All in all, it's nonsense. And that was just the start of what's been a very interesting weekend full of silly season mayhem and other nonsense.
That's putting it mild, to say the least, let me tell you. More on that shortly. Also joining me, smug as ever from yet another Porsche IMSA-related victory. Hello, Mr. Cameron Buckley. How are we?
Sadly, I cannot gather enough watches in the house to represent what Felipe Nasr now owns.
Melt them all down and turn it into a big one like your Flavor Flav, only somehow far less charismatic. Does that sound like a solution? No?
I don't understand. You are speaking an alien language to me right now. This was going to be a very casual, me being very smug Rolex 24 episode. And then in the space of about 36 hours, MotoGP decided to bring all the news all at once. Well, not really. More in every 3 hours, a bombshell hit for about a day.
Look, you got things to listen to. Like right now, you probably know who's won the snow delayed cookout clash, right? There's nothing else going on for another few weeks. The F1 shakedown just wrapped up. I think we can talk about it. I'm not sure. It's very interesting that they've promoted a private shakedown event like any other open test that they would have had the last few years. But what do I know? I don't work for Formula One management.
It's weird in the sense of, it was pretty clearly demonstrated as a private shakedown from the start. And yet Formula One brings a full crew down to record it for video highlight sake, have driver interviews exclusively from down there, but then doesn't invite the media and doesn't let fans in to watch it. Don't get me wrong, I'm kind of in two minds about it, in the sense of, one, like, I don't think F1 tried to swindle anybody on purpose on this one. While at the same time, we fans have got to stop asking for blood out of a stone to get every drop of information it can get for what was always going to be a private shakedown. Weird as hell, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, we'll talk more about that during our actual F1 season preview, probably around a month from now after we get our two main Bahrain tests. The actual public ones that we actually are going to likely watch, as background noise on Sky Sports F1.
And if you know how this season is going after the shakedown, no, you don't. Dre, tell the good folks where they can find us.
Well, I will in a second, but a certain someone who read the script changed it so that...
Because there's been some good news for you lately. You don't have to go back to the mill. The mill being the bookies or anything else. Dre, congratulations on the new job.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Yes, for those who haven't seen my socials in the last couple of days, I'll tell you where you can find me in a minute if you haven't already. I'm no longer fun employed. Starting tomorrow, believe it or not, as I'm recording this on February 1st, I am a social content creator for Crash.net. So I will be heading over there to promote the ever-loving bejesus out of the Crash MotoGP and Formula One departments mostly. That's where I'm going to be. I'm going to be in the back doing a lot of the grinding, making sure everybody sounds great, as well as figuring out how to promote and actually grow this thing. They have a fantastic team of journalists over there. Peter McLaren's fantastic. Lewis Duncan, who I worked with at AutoSport. You know, great journos, great team. Looking forward to working with them and looking forward to giving them the platform that they deserve, quite frankly. So, I say this sincerely, it's been a long and hard 6 months. I genuinely did not think that I'd be working in motorsport again after being let go by the network back in August. So from the bottom of my heart, a sincere thank you to everyone who put a word in, spread the word about me, kept looking out for gigs for me and then sending them my way and thinking of me. I'm very blessed to have a wonderful community and set of friends that give enough of a shit that they want to see me do well and they want to help me get my foot back in the door, because it's hard, man. It is so hard. I mean, I was on Job Seekers. I was talking to people that just wanted to stack shelves, let alone have the luxury of being able to work in an industry that they genuinely love doing. So it really puts your shit in perspective, let me tell you. So again, a sincere thank you to everyone who's been so kind and generous and supportive. I say it many a time, you guys are the best audience in the world, and I'm so grateful to be able to have this and share this with you. Don't worry, M101 stuff is not going anywhere or anything along those lines. I will still be doing my thing here as well. That was non-negotiable when it comes to getting these gigs, and that stands here too. So
can't get rid of us that easily.
Never. I've done 600 shows. You're not killing me off without a fight, let me tell you. But thank you all once again. Now with my self-indulgence out of the way. Here's where you can find us in the meantime. Well, you can find us at motorsport101.com, our website, with all the details on that and more, including part one of a two-part series about what we're about to talk about when it comes to MotoGP silly season. More on that very shortly. You can find us on Blue Sky, Dre Harrison, RJ O'Connell, cbuckley917.bsky.social if you want to follow us on there. If you're still on the horrible AI-generated site with the bird on it, you can do so at motorsport_101. You can follow us on there. You can follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube if you want video highlights of the show as well. YouTube, motorsport101, motorsport101 pod on Instagram, and M101_podcast on TikTok if you haven't already. And if you really, really like us, of course, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You can upgrade that to $10 to get Discord access, as well as being able to listen to these shows live as they're being recorded, as Jason and Ghost Raptor are doing so right now. Thank you for your ongoing support, folks. Much appreciated. Oh, and just before I move on as well, I forgot to mention, our previous AI bot problem has been solved. So if you're in one of those countries I mentioned a couple of months ago, like Brazil, like Hong Kong, and a few countries all around the world that had AI, malicious AI problems all over the place, that has now been resolved. So we are truly a global website again. apologies again for the inconvenience that then took so long to clear up. Again, our website designer, Steph, is an angel, and I love that woman to death. So thank you, thank you, Steph, and the great team she's got with her partner at Silver Code. Much appreciated. Thank you so much, as ever. Right, I've spoken for long enough for the last few minutes in a row. Let's get into our huge catch-up session. First of all, MotoGP and the explosive 2027 silly season news mill right after this.
Bam. Gentlemen, it's all kicking off because within a 24-hour period on Friday, all of these reported by Yuri Puigdemont and Motorsport.com and Diario AS, AS.com, the Spanish publication, the following blockbuster MotoGP transfers have been reported in this order. 1. Fabio Quartararo, former MotoGP world champion with Yamaha, has agreed on a 2-year deal to leave Yamaha and go to Honda. Following that, Jorge Martin, 2024 MotoGP world champion, going the other way to join Yamaha after leaving Aprilia. And sometime down the road, we got the third one, Pedro Acosta of KTM, replacing Francesco Bagnaia at the factory Ducati team. I need to stress that none of these have been officially confirmed by riders, the teams involved, etc. But there is enough smoke to these to where we report these as, unless something drastic changes, they're happening. So I'll let you two gentlemen tackle these. I mean, where do you want to start?
I want to start with when I first heard this, which was me playing video games at like 4 a.m. after the most recent GT7 update. I'm testing the new Porsche, which has the best brakes of like any racing car in a game right now. Dre leaps into the chat, goes, "Cam, you see the news?" I'm like, "The hell are you talking about?" "Cam, general, the news." Fabio Quartararo to Honda? On motorsport.com?
I was in shock. Again, as RJ Corradi says, none of these have been officially confirmed, but when David Emmett, who we've always gassed up on motomatters.com, says that Yuri Puigdemont is the best MotoGP journalist in the world, take it as kosher. And David's a very humble man, and he would never be, he's very sincere when he says that. If it comes from Yuri, I've been very fortunate and blessed to work with that man on Tank Slappers. He is a phenomenal journalist, one of the very best in motorsport. And if it's coming from him, it's kosher. That was 9:45 on Friday morning, and I was in shock. I genuinely, I mean, to put it into perspective, if a rider gets announced during the opening weekend, which is traditionally Qatar in MotoGP, it's now been Thailand for the last couple of years, but traditionally, it's been Qatar, and if there wasn't a rider announcement then, we would consider that extremely early. Like, normally, you don't start getting meteor MotoGP seat confirmations till after the summer break, around August, going into September, that kind of time. So, for three major game-breaking moves, two of them involving world champions, and one of them the biggest prospect in the sport right now, is enormous. It's earth shattering. It's incredible.
It redefines the field.
Yeah.
Right. Because like, and three world champions, given one of them appears to be, to have ended up as collateral in all this, with Pecco, like Fabio to Honda. Now, I don't think he's published it on his own website, so I'll leave the name off of it, but a certain someone who we do gas up on this show said Fabio decided to leave in Misano last year.
Yeah. Why is Misano important?
Because that is when they debuted, I believe, their V4 prototype with Augusto Fernandez in a race setting. Tried it and said, "Nah, I'm good. I'm out. Deuces."
Startling. And don't get me wrong. Like, I think it would be harsh to firmly draw a valid conclusion from that weekend because, one, Augusto Fernandez is a very solid MotoGP rider. He was not the quickest in the world. but he did make a bit of a Horlicks of it over the course of that weekend. He was not particularly competitive and also crashed a couple of times in low speed conditions at turn two. Wasn't ideal, but it says a lot. I mean, this has been coming for a while. I just didn't think it was going to be Honda. And I'll talk about that in a bit more detail in a moment. But if you know the backstory of Fabio Quartararo, it has been him poking Yamaha with a cattle prod for the last 4 years, basically telling them, do something, figure this out. And it was really around Assen when I was still working for the Motorsport Network at the time and I was doing their socials. And I distinctly remember putting the quote in the box of, this was when they were unveiling the 75th anniversary white Yamaha bikes for that Assen weekend. And he openly said to MotoGP.com in the media, they need to show some form of improvement with the V4, otherwise I'm gone. I was like, damn, he said that during the big unveiling?
Celebration.
That was a man who had had enough. It's easy to say in hindsight, but that was a man that was just about at his wit's end with what Yamaha was.
Right after that, did they not, where he did get to sample it?
It was at the end of the season at Valencia. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. He has only had 3 podiums. Fabio Quartararo is one of the riders that has been very fortunate to have not missed any Grand Prix weekends over the last 3 years, which is, again, a godsend given how much we race now. Has not missed a race, only 4 podiums to show for it. Has not won a race since 2022 at Germany. He has lost 3 prime years. He turns 27 in April. It's just, we made a big deal about how Honda had circled the drain, especially after Mark has left. Yamaha's decline has not been as pronounced. Man,
that drop off a shelf like Honda had the literal second they lost Mark. It was more gradual than that, but really mid 2022, Ducati finally cracks the whole code with the Decimo-Sedici, the 22, the ride height device, the aero, all of it comes together under Pecco. And it was like, it was like someone turned out the lights at Yamaha. Because Fabio just hemorrhaged points. They just hemorrhaged points the rest of the way home. And really the big thing we talked about, because like the inline four MotoGP bike is dead. They've pivoted to the V4 because all of this modern technology that makes these bikes race like shit has kind of invalidated the existence of the inline four and what it gives you from a handling perspective. He's tried the V4 and it has a lot of the same problems as the inline four bike had, namely a lack of rear grip. Just ask Honda about that, who have only really just come back into the fold in the last year in that regard. Yamaha overturned the whole bike to kind of end up where they already were, if you believe like how Fabio has reacted to the bike.
Now, again, I wouldn't exactly call that an exact science because Fabio Quartararo is not a development guy. He's not the sort of guy that you can... He's not a Johann Zarco or a Luca Marini, someone you can lean on to give you development advice. He is a get over the fairing and ride the shit out of it kind of guy. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that.
Yeah.
It's just...
Marquez is the same way.
Yeah, it's just when you're in a pinch... Unfortunately, Fabio's not going to be the one to dig you out of the hole in that sense. And last season was the epitome of that for me. I mean, he had 5 pole positions last year. Only Marc Marquez, the eventual champion, had more than him over the course of the year. And we saw it time and time again. This Yamaha, even in inline four mode, was not slow if it was in the perfect performance window. It was quick. There is no doubt about that. But the moment...
He's through the eye of a needle.
But the moment you knocked it out of its comfort zone, if it was too hot, too cold, if there was not enough tire grip, not enough tire wear, etc., the moment you knocked it out of its ideal window, it fell like a stone. On average, last year, he had an average start of 5. He had an average finish of 10. So on average, he was losing 5 places in the race.
Dre, what was the telltale? Every single start, besides really Silverstone, where the bike let him down anyway. Fabio Quartararo, -5 off the line.
Yeah. Within 3 laps, he'd be back down in 4th or 5th place, because not only was it there were quicker bikes behind him, the moment one bike got in front of him, the Yamaha lacks the top speed and the edge grip to be able to fight back and combat with people. So naturally, it would just keep falling down the order quickly, because unlike Brad Pitt, they didn't design a bike for combat because of the Yamaha.
It lacks raceability.
Yes.
And it unfortunately looks like the V4 has not really solved anything in that besides the potential for raw horsepower. They're still going to be learning this bike anyway, but it almost turned into a less vicious version of what Marc Marquez had to become his last year with Honda, which is just riding at 13 tenths and crashing more often than not because he's just trying to get blood from a stone.
Yamaha is a really interesting spot because the other big move that came in minutes after this is Jorge Martin going from Aprilia to Yamaha. So immediately you replace one world champion with another, which I guess kind of puts them in a better spot than Honda was when Marc Marquez left.
It's something.
They got Mir, and that has not worked out amazingly, let's just say. I mean, I don't know what Jorge Martin is doing, man.
I've said this from day one, and I will continue to say this. You will never be able to convince a MotoGP rider otherwise if they think the ride that they are on is too dangerous for them. And I think that's been the ever-present theme of Jorge Martin since joining Aprilia from Ducati last year. He had the off-season from hell in 2024, going into 25, crashed at the Catalunya test, crashed in the Sepang test, crashed in pre-season training, nearly died in Qatar the one weekend he came back from those initial injuries, missed 7 Grand Prix with 11 broken ribs and a punctured lung. Came back, was actually reasonably solid. First weekend back was 7th in Brno. I remember the 4th at Balaton from 17th on the grid. Like, the speed was there the moment he came back, in all fairness to him. But then the Japanese collarbone injury he got, where he crashed into his own teammate at turn one with Marco Bezzecchi, effectively ending his season. And what does it say that at the first possible opportunity into the new year, he's maneuvered an exit, especially off the back of the initial try to leave scandal of 2024, which was the biggest story of the year in MotoGP? The fact that Martin actively tried to break his contract early, you know, talked about an injury, talked about a top 5 scoring clause he had in his deal. Aprilia argued that that clause was irrelevant because of the fact that Martin was injured, and it got dragged out for 3 months over awkward public appearances. Aprilia saying, let's just all be friends again, let bygones be bygones. And then
Arno was willing to park him as a rider.
Well, they had to, because
get him his house in order.
Yeah, Kamel Espinosa had no choice, because you can't have a registered MotoGP rider who's in contract limbo. Who's he supposed to be riding for? Honda wanted Jorge Martin last year, and I think this is ultimately why they've made a play for Quartararo so quickly, because they couldn't get Martin. But Honda had to back off, because they had a gentleman's agreement with Massimo Rivera Aprilia to say, we're not going to officially approach your rider until we know what his contract status is. So it just did not work for Martin. Martin had every element of the sport against him. And to be fair, it's not the first time Martin's kicked up a stink over contracts. Now, the Ducati...
It's everywhere he's ever been, he kicks up a stink over contracts.
And to be fair, the Ducati one wasn't his fault. Ducati went back on a handshake agreement, you know, and that is shitty practice, no matter how you slice it. Man got DeAndre Jordan, and that's, you know...
But when you have an opportunity to bring in Marc Marquez to your team, you do it, I suppose. And it worked!
That's the point. It's a small forward-thinking note to Pedro Acosta. Even Valentino Rossi talked about this a couple of years ago, where he said, Ducati used to have this structure where it would bring its riders up through the up through the pyramid of talent towards the factory. But they had Marco Bezzecchi. Beko Bagnaia came through that system. Fabio Di Giantonio came up through that system. They had a funneling path. Even Enea Bastini, who wasn't a VR46 guy, was in that pipeline. But the moment Marc Marquez became available, plus the luxury of being on the best bike, you hold all the aces. So why not trade in all those chips, those first-round draft picks, if you were making a basketball comparison? Why not dump them all to bring in your present and future to have Marc Marquez and Pedro Acosta on the same team? We'll talk about Acosta a bit more in a minute, because obviously there's more to say about Martin. But, I mean, if you're Yamaha, it's a good guy to bring in, and I think there's still more than enough wiggle room to back Martin up with somebody else, because there's other names in the mix as well. But what is Jorge Martin's headspace? And at what point do you go, is he the boy who cries wolf? The guy who can't get back to what he was at Ducati and is going to make everybody else's life difficult? I wonder, is this man genuinely difficult to work with if things don't work out? I don't know.
That's the thing, like, what evidence do we have that the Yamaha is safer than the Aprilia? We've seen people crash on it left and right last year, overriding it to get results out of it.
Yeah. And again, I'm not sure if Martin will have that same approach that Fabio did, where, you know, ride at 11 temps to try and just extract and go over the limit to try and get a result, where, you know, as opposed to riding more conservative and just taking what the bike will give you. But this is the third manufacturer and the third different bike that Jorge Martin has ridden in the last 4 years.
Yeah, he still hasn't even really rode the Aprilia all that much.
Yeah, and when he has, it's not been at 100%.
Yeah, he's been injured for most of the time he's been on an Aprilia, and he's only had 7 full race weekends since joining the team out of a possible 22.
All of which he has looked demonstratively slower than Marco Bezzecchi because of him trying to come back from these injuries. So we haven't really seen what he could look like at his full potential with Aprilia. I don't know if we'll see it at all this season, if I'm honest.
Because we're also in a situation now where 2027 is right around the corner. This is the last year of a regulation set. You can't communicate with these riders about development now. They're effectively frozen out because they could take the company silver and go to their new teams and use that against you. So if anything, they've now frozen themselves out in February with a brand new bike due next year with massive regulation changes. And now Fabio Quartararo is helpless, even more than he normally is. Because, well, what can Yamaha do with him? They can't give him shit because he's now a competitor. You know, same
with... It's not just a competitor, their sworn enemy.
Yeah, he's gone
on the same soil.
He's gone across party lines. This is like a conservative MP defecting to Labour. That never happens.
It's the inverse.
This is like a conservative MP Honda defecting over to Reform. That always happens.
One thing I'm absolutely certain of is that he's not going to do what Rossi did in 2004, which is take a picture of the 211V over to the engineers and go, make it ride like this.
Yes.
No, do not do that. And I mean, to mention Honda for a minute, Honda has their talisman rider. Like, they just picked up the next best person they could get after Marc Marquez left. Uh-huh. And going into a new rule set, Honda actually looked pretty solid in testing.
Yeah.
Under Aleix Espargaró. They are on a pretty good upward trajectory. Still not perfect. Far from it. They're still a shell of what they used to be. But at the best, Honda could be a top 5 bike last year if everything lined up together. Four podiums, one win, even if it was under the goofiest of circumstances. There is reason to be optimistic here, especially going into a new rule set, because the things that the Japanese manufacturers have been bad at, ride height devices and aerodynamics, aeros being stripped back heavily, ride height devices, rest in piss, you won't be missed. going into next year. So I think that's the best possible move Fabio could have made.
And
I don't think Ducati was ever going to pick him up.
I've said for some time, I don't think Ducati needed to go out of its way to sign a big name free agent, but they have anyway.
Well, they did. You said that for a while, and then they went and got Marc Marquez, and it worked out reasonably well, I'd say.
Marc Marquez is the greatest MotoGP rider of all time, and the parameters are slightly different here.
Fabio isn't Marc, but he's still pretty good.
You are trying to move the goalposts from Sunday League to the Premier League, my friend. There's a bit of a difference here.
Not having both?
I mean, like I said about 5 minutes ago, when you've got the luxury of the best bike in the sport and the luxury of having people that want to ride for you, you can trade in all that leverage and blow up your structure and bring in the best rider that's ever lived, in my opinion, and in my opinion, with Acosta, a future world champion that will inevitably win world titles in red one day. I don't know when that day will be, but Pedro Acosta is already well on that trajectory. We forget he is still only 21 years old, and he already has 10 podium finishes. Somehow he has not won a Grand Prix yet. He almost certainly will in the next 24 months, I reckon. He's a tremendous talent and a genuine entertainer, a very charismatic rider off the bike. He is everything you could want in a talented prospect joining a big hitting team. This was inevitable with Pedro, and it's been no secret he'd been shopping himself out to anyone who'd be prepared to listen to get him out of that KTM deal. And again, what does it say that first possible opportunity Ducati sniped him up the moment he became available after January 1st. Says it all, doesn't it, really?
Well, in the collateral on all this, Pecco Bagnaia, the way that you are, probably just cost him his world championship winning seat.
It feels dirty. I feel bad for Pecco.
It feels weird.
That is the most successful rider in Ducati's history. 31 top flight wins, 2 world championships. He was the banker. He was the 100% hoper. He was the original super prospect in that Ducati camp. He was the star graduate of the VR46 Academy. Already came in with a world championship when he won in Moto2. It feels weird that just the one underperforming season since his rookie year in the top flight back in 2019 would be enough for him to lose his job. I think the timing was bad for Pecco, don't get me wrong, but to not even give him a second chance with your brand new bike and already basically saying, well, we already think you're not good enough for this anymore, we're letting you go for Pedro, that's sad. That is
not unprecedented, Dre, because remember, the last previous most successful rider in Ducati's history was a man by the name of Andrea Dovizioso, who gave them everything except a MotoGP World Championship. And after 2020, they decided, nope, you're gone, pal. We like this Bagnaia kid. Isn't that deeply ironic?
And before that, they told Jorge Lorenzo to kick rocks. And then they finally gave him the fuel tank that he wanted to brace himself against the bike, and he won 2 out of 3 races.
And by that point, they already decided that the Dino Petrucci was the better option for that bike.
And before that, they had a contract lined up for Andrea Iannone. He had one teammate take out crash, and they ripped it up and told him to pack his bags.
Yeah. Ducati, even by the generally harsh standards we hold the treatment of its pilots in motorsport to, Ducati is particularly ruthless. If they do not think you're the guy, they will show you the door. No ifs, no buts, no questions asked.
Doesn't this sound familiar, Dre? It's like if they were wearing blue and they were sponsored by, like, I don't know, an energy drink or something, this would be round the clock, like, news cycle shit whenever they let go of a guy seemingly unfairly.
Okay, imagine, if you will, then Max Verstappen underperforms this year. No, that's not a realistic prediction.
No, it's not.
against Isak Hadjar, and then Red Bull's like, you're sack, get the fuck out.
yeah, we're going to get rid of you for Arvid Lindblad, who had like a 100-point season, and to the surprise of everybody in Formula One. Like, that's what the equivalent of that would be. It's very harsh treatment. And don't get me wrong, we were the first to roast Pecco over on open fire when shit went bad at the end of last year. But it would be one, harsh to say, like, Ben Garbagnier is fully responsible for those struggles, because ultimately, as a Ducati team, it's your job to fix those issues. And they ultimately failed in that with Pecco. And even then, surely he's earned enough goodwill over the last half decade where he deserved a second year to try and figure this out. That's all
I'm looking at. That, for me, is the shock. Like, they didn't even wait for the season to get started. They didn't even wait for the first test to conclude.
Yeah. They were like, we've seen enough after 2025. We're going off the Acosta. Which is just wild.
And now the question, of course, becomes, where does Pecco go? Because there is swirling, conflicting reports. The easy one, I think, would be VR46.
Agreed.
However, like, what is his relationship with Ducati at that stage? Because they've just sacked him from the factory team.
Does he get a factory bug if he goes to VR46? Because remember, Fabio Di Giantonio owns one of those right now.
And Fermin Aldeguer will own one of those in a year's time.
Yeah. Like, where are your bikes going to end up? Because Alex Marquez is on a GP26 for this year, despite being a customer as well. So if you're going to have four factory bikes out of your six, which four is going to get them in 2027, assuming Magnaia goes to VR46? I don't know.
And that's assuming he goes to VR46. You have other rumors, like, out of people over at GP1 thinking that is going to be a 2024 protagonist meetup over at Yamaha of Pecco and Martin in the same team. I can't even imagine how frosty that garage would be.
Oh boy.
Well, at this point, I was just thinking, like, well, Aprilia's got to have somebody to come in and replace Jorge Martin, right? And that's the best available rider. But even then, it doesn't seem all that straightforward. I mean, you mentioned Alex Marquez. Maverick Vinales is on the board. There are other ripple effects of people that it affects.
If I'm in a contract year and I'm not involved in this series of nonsense, I am lunging for that second Aprilia seat.
That clearly is the money seat. I know Aprilia, if they could, would love Pecco Bagnaia. They've always wanted the all-Italian dream team. They've been chasing that vision for a long time.
Very clear every time they run a press release about how Ducati aren't real Italians because it's the Germans paying the bill up at Volkswagen.
Yeah, Max Biaggi, it's a German team, not an Italian one, because Max Biaggi had never seen a fight that he hadn't made. But yeah,
well, he usually loses them. Just ask Valentino.
Beasting. But yes, the thing about it is, Aprilia would love Pecco. I don't think they can afford him, because Pecco is on stupid money. He's on like $10 million a year at Ducati. Aprilia,
he ain't making that anywhere unless he goes to Yamaha.
And Aprilia are probably the smallest of the five manufacturers on the grid in terms of resources and funds. Like,
you know, there's another.
Depends on KTM expenditure versus money in the reserves.
Or CF Moto, whatever we're calling them.
Or whoever owns their racing division by this time next year, which is up for debate, quite frankly. But I'd say on paper, Aprilia are the smallest of the five manufacturers. And with that in mind, they probably wouldn't be able to afford a rider of Pecco's quality. And Andrea Bastianini will be in the mix, because he's in a contract year at Tech Free right now at the moment. And I think that could be the guy that ends up at Aprilia. Alex Marquez has apparently told people behind the scenes he wants factory money. For those who don't know, and again, spoke to David Emmett about this, at the average satellite rider in MotoGP makes a lot less money than you think. Their basic salary is about 300,000 euros, which is next to nothing for what these dudes do. There's obviously win bonuses. There's bonuses in those contracts. Obviously, there's marketing incentives. That involves winning,
which doesn't happen all that often on a satellite.
One that involves winning, and two, MotoGP is famously really bad at brand activations and sponsorship acquisition and things like that. So, like, Alex has cashed in a lot of goodwill at Gresini. He would like to be paid like a factory rider somewhere, because Gresini cannot afford to pay Alex Marquez factory-type money. And that's why he's apparently shopping to KTM and Yamaha right now, if they can afford to put him on a factory deal that'll pay him a lot more bread. It makes sense. You know, and again, Moto2 is going to be a fight next year. It is going to be a Australian-level bar fight.
9 or 10 realistic shots at the title on that grid.
Danny Holgado just got thrown out of a nightclub, and David Alonso is about to accidentally throw a chair from next door at him. It's
whatever you do, do not let any of that fight end up in the Waffle House. The staff will get involved.
Yes, like, I reckon Holgado, Alonso, Manu Gonzalez, Barry Baltus, Aaron Canet, Dennis Onshu, they could all get involved in the Moto2 title picture next year. Even Nicolo Bulliger in World Superbikes, with that Pirelli knowledge, could be an ace in the hole for a team to potentially take a punt on him for 2027.
Whatever number you're thinking of for World Superbike wins this year for Nicolo Bulliger, take the over.
Yeah, to take the over. So
it's going to be crazy. There's going to be a lot of guys that you wouldn't think are at risk of losing their place on MotoGP entirely that are probably in place of losing their place in MotoGP entirely. Franco Morbidelli, sure, I get it. This is probably his last chance. There's no way. There has to be no way that Yoann Mir and Enea Bastianini are already on Last Chance City, right? There's no way that Ayagura could have his career broken after just two seasons.
It would shock me if anything changes around a track house unless Raul gets plugged into that seat at the factory, which is very possible. He finished the end of last year strong.
Very strong.
Mir needs to stop crashing the goddamn bike.
Yeah, a lot of this could also boil down to, does Honda go back to the well for somebody else? Does Honda clean house, or do they have to pick between Marini and Mir for their second bike? Because the LCRs are locked in. They're the only team with a fully locked-in rider lineup for next year, with Zarco on a 2-year deal and Diogo Moreira, the rookie, on a 3-year deal. So that's the only teams in the sport that are ironclad. The only other guy who's contracted secure is Toprak with Pramac. He's on a 2-year deal. He's off sequence. Everybody else is potentially up for grabs. So good luck.
Yeah, and like, it really comes down to, what does Honda value more? We know Mir has a higher upside, but usually he's on the low side, on the ground, scraping his leathers. With Marini, you have someone who probably doesn't have that raw edge at the peak of his speed, but he has great development ability, and Honda still needs that. You have that with him, you have that with Zarco. Two minds developing that bike, along with Alesh in the background, who's been doing a great job thus far.
Mm-hmm.
This is still not the standard of the Honda Motor Company. These last few years, they've been called that for nothing, and they can't keep being called that for nothing.
Indeed, they've got to figure this out. So we'll keep you posted over the course of the year. Of course, if any more MotoGP news drops, we'll be first on the scene with that. Yeah. But
just give us a few weeks, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just give us a few weeks. We need to recover from this. Gentlemen, I think we should catch up on IndyCar content days, right? Because, you know, it's a pretty uneventful offseason. I mean, we still don't know who's driving the second Dale Coyne car, but we think it's Romain Grosjean, because they've not been good at keeping that under wraps. I mean, it's a good thing that, like, no other nonsense is going to happen. No other race are going to go join the calendar. And hold on, I'm getting something weird. Oh, they did what? And it's when? Why? For what? Okay, so Friday, announced via executive order from the White House of the United States of America.
That's never a good thing in 2025 or 26. Only bad things follow that sentence.
That IndyCar is adding an 18th race to the 2026 schedule. To celebrate 250 years of the United States of America, they will race on the streets around Washington, D.C.'s Capitol building on the 23rd of August. It's called the Freedom 250 Grand Prix. I know what you're thinking. Why not revive the Freedom 100 in Indianapolis as an IndyNet showcase round? This one is 2.5 times better. Clearly, obviously, it's going to be the 18th race of the season. IndyCar is going to finish the year with a quintuple header of 6 races in the final 5 weekends, because we'll still have a double header at the Milwaukee Mile. My questions are in order. Why? How? And for motherfucking what? We have joked this, other people from other countries, I've been guilty of this joke about, like, oh, Miami and Vegas are sports washing, right? Because we're adding more races in the United States when things are bad in the United States. But at least those do not give off the vibes of being purely propped up by the United States government to cover for all the atrocious shit going on in this country, where we are abducting people left and right, thanks to ICE, where we are killing civilians, right?
Executing civilians on the street for excess. Look, the Bill of Rights is effectively dead. We know that.
This is genuine, honest to God sports washing, and I never thought it'd come to my doorstep. And I know that probably sounds ignorant, maybe I never thought of it this way. Why? Why here?
You know,
why IndyCar, right?
You know, elsewhere, there is actually kind of like one of the discords I'm very active in. There's actually a hard ban on political talk because it used to not be banned and it used to get pretty nasty. And I would usually be involved in those fights. And they've actually had to semi-lift that as a result of this, because there was no other option.
Right.
Because this is inherently waving an executive order in the same, just a day before Trump literally shit himself on television. It's out there. You can hear it. And that's the best thing he's done in that administration for the last year and a half. It hasn't been a year and a half. It's February 2026. I can't do math. And fucking IndyCar.
Why?
Roger. I know he's your boy, but fuck off.
It's very interesting that Porsche Penske had a media roundtable leading up to the Rolex 24, and Roger made it no secret that he was not happy about these tariffs screwing over his business, the loss of the EV tax credits screwing over his business. And I'm just thinking, is this him just trying to be like, Donald, you got to stop this. This is hurting my bottom line. What'll it take for you to just not screw over my business, right? But the thing is, like, among the other, like, ugly things about this, they're going to try and organize this in 7 months.
Yeah, last minute addition into was a quintuple header, you said?
Yes.
Yes.
So that is back to back to back to back to back.
Yes.
To finish out this season for teams that already have other responsibilities, because they often share components between teams and other sports. That's another race these engines have to last with a disgruntled engine manufacturer who we know is kind of 1.9 feet out the door already, unless they get charters. That old chestnut.
I've held back on this segment for a moment because I've let the Americans say their piece, and I wanted to spend 2-3 minutes talking about this anyway because I feel very strongly about this. I am a British IndyCar fan. There is not very many of us, but maybe less than 10,000 of us, I reckon, given this is a very niche series for America, let alone across the pond. And we and the Americans here in Britain share a lot in common with the way our governments are run, with the way our people are being treated, with the way our governments
learned everything from you, Dad.
The phrase I always use is the UK is the US only 4 years behind. That's my general rule of thumb, and I like to stick to that. Here's where I'm at with this. First of all, it reeks. Like, purely from a logistical standpoint, it reeks of desperation from IndyCar. It reeks of twerking for the White House, because the White House released, and the week before this was officially announced, a very AI slop generated video of the concept of them racing around the Capitol building, including single file restarts, three cars to a row, you know, Abraham Lincoln statue looking around and looking at the grid as it happened, a US Army branded IndyCar. It was the definition of AI slop, and it was just, I was like, this is just shameless about how much they're twerking towards IndyCar to bring a race over here. And of course, IndyCar took the bait, hook, line, and sinker, and scrambled to advertise this. And to the point where a week later, they've now got an 18th race on the schedule that now makes the back end of the season a logistical nightmare, with six races in the final 5 weekends darted all over the country. Yes, this is the East Coast race that the IndyCar fans have wanted for a long time, but at what cost?
It ain't the one I wanted.
Yes. And then there's the darker element of this. There's the fact that this is an endorsement of the fucking horrible Trump administration and what this is. Like, I cannot stress enough, Rene Good was executed in cold blood. Alex Pretti's body is still warm. That was a week ago. He was murdered by ICE. It's the embryonic steps of another civil war in the United States as to what's going on and how flimsy everything is, that one person can release a propaganda video and then Donald Trump will send 2,000 IC agents into an entire state over battlegrounds.
Dre, it's so flimsy that MAGA ditched their load-bearing amendment. Right. They said, actually, no, fuck the Second Amendment, because Donald Trump said so. You can't open carry in an open carry state. You cannot exercise your load-bearing amendment. Because we knew they didn't give a fuck about
the first. This is the thing, man. All these executive orders are basically just them, like, this is a thing because I said so. Oh, you want to run a street race with Indy cars outside your, on the streets outside your house after you run a UFC fight in your front yard? Of course you do! Happy 12th birthday!
It is exactly that. It is the
everyone stubborn, is 12 theory.
It's the stubborn, brainless ramblings and birthday-esque requests from a man with an IQ of 19 who just wants all his presents lined up in a row so he can smash two cars against each other on his front lawn and he can go home happy. Like RJ said, they're not the first. The UFC's got a White House card later on this year on the White House lawn. Like Raptor in the chat has mentioned it before as well. They can't even legally advertise around the Capitol building, despite the fact that Graham, I'm twerking for the Republicans, Ray Hall, is out here bragging on Twitter that sponsors are lining up to fill out his car for that race, despite
you don't think that they're going to sign another executive order saying, yeah, we can advertise for this weekend. Of course they will.
Because every law is flimsy when the entire MO of an administration is because I say so.
Absolutely. And it's just like,
and we know all this. And again, I assume that the people that listen to this show, and it's not a huge amount of people, but you guys are educated. You know that we have no problem discussing very difficult topics. We have no problem dabbling in politics because politics and motorsport do go hand in hand. Anyone who says that they're not are living a very privileged livelihood where they can afford to ignore that bullshit. We don't on this show. It is abhorrent that IndyCar has shamelessly bent over backwards to facilitate this bullshit because they are so desperate for people to watch them. They had to have looked at this and thought, oh, I bet we can get 1.5 million viewers by having a race at the Capitol building. People will tune in for that. They will. I know they will because America loves its patriotism.
They're saying it's free admission. They're saying it's free admission. I'm sure it is. I'm sure that you know, just like
just like the MAGA people thought that the Capitol building on January 6th was free admission.
We thought the World Cup coming up here in a few months was going to be fairly priced. Oh, buddy, no, it ain't. No. And we know Gianni Infantino is doing Cirque du Soleil on it for this administration, and he's not even American.
And you know what the funniest part about all this is? Over half the grid are immigrants on the IndyCar grid. There's actually a lack of Americans in the grand scheme of things. There are many people of color that are representing the series. One of them is Pato O'Ward. He's probably the face of IndyCar from a social media standpoint. And he's not exactly covered himself in glory the last couple of months.
Working for Charlie Kirk.
You know, it's ironic that you were twerking this hard for a series to come to your grounds to start a race where a Mexican and a Spaniard are the two best drivers in your series. A pair of immigrants. Funny how that turns out. It's shameful. It's shameful and it's disgraceful. And I'm extremely disappointed in IndyCar for twerking this hard to get a race on the White House lawn. And I'm disappointed that so many people that I considered friends and people I respect have turned a blind eye because they know it's good for the wallet if they endorse this. Like, Scott McLaughlin should know better. Santino Ferrucci doesn't surprise me at all. Graham Rahal. He doesn't
know better. He's proven that enough times.
Yeah, Graham Rahal is not a surprise at all. The people who know about how the people within this series get down know. I've said it on Blue Sky and I'll say it again here. IndyCar is far more Republican than people want to acknowledge. And it's disappointing that left-leaning political thinkers like us have to just stand back in horror while, like I mentioned before, Alex Pretti's body is still warm, and we're talking about advertising an IndyCar race on the White House lawn. This series could not have its head any more up its own arse if it tried right now. It's pathetic. And
if this race goes to shambles, right? If this race goes to shambles, let's say it's an absolute joke of a race. And let's assume it even gets done, right? Because It's not a lot of time. Oh, you just put temporary barriers around a track and watch it go. There's a lot more effort that comes in all this. If it becomes a flop or if it doesn't even happen at all, nobody is going to feel sorry for you that this was the biggest failure of your season. And to that point, if this is the thing that's supposed to get IndyCar back into mainstream relevance, right? Because you're now number three behind Formula One, and NASCAR, even off inertia, has been kicking your butt for the past 30 years plus. If this is what's supposed to give us more than just the same 900,000 people watching every weekend, I'd have much rather have the same 9,000 people watching every weekend, because at least I trust their nonsense. Don't get me into bed with these motherfuckers.
Well, and I'll tell you, I was planning on going to at least one IndyCar race this year. That money will be going somewhere else, probably to the Frances, unfortunately, who are not only not better, are probably worse. Because
they already got their centennial race in San Diego.
Unfortunately, the sport that we love, that we talk about, that is in the name of this podcast, is inherently really fucking right wing. It's something that you kind of just have to take with the territory, being a motorsport fan. But damn.
You can't bring it up every 2 hours for the sake of attention, like some people that are clearly on the right side of things, but just clearly want to do it for the clout, because it's always somebody named Jordan. I digress. It's not great. This is just... a shambles.
Talk about this as part of the IndyCar portion of our catch up. We haven't even talked about the fact that the unchartered team Prema is hemorrhaging out of everything. Employees,
Long Beach.
Money, everything.
They'll be at Long Beach on the positive side. Callum Ilott signed a deal to drive full-time at IMSA, hedging his bets because he didn't know if he was going to have a ride this season in IndyCar or not. If it goes great, he'll be very busy. If it doesn't, at least he got one ride.
The unchartered team in this sport is being picked over by vultures. And Roger Penske's favorite son, X, is no longer X's favorite son because he's back on the three car. What was firing Tim Cindric if you were just going to bring him back as his race engineer?
Laughable. It's absolutely laughable.
It's all going so well.
Honestly, like, I cannot think of any racing series that has, like, as mentioned before, about a million hardcore fans. It reminds me a lot of TNA wrestling. They have this hardcore million strong audience of people that will watch anything they put out, even the races that aren't the Indy 500. And yet the people that run this series keep finding more creative ways to shoot themselves in the dick. I find it impressive that they are about to alienate themselves.
Great analogy. This is IndyCar bringing in Hulk Hogan for the pub.
Oh, God, do not remind me. Less said about that, the better. We'll take a quick musical break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about IMSA's Rolex 24 when I dunk my hand in a bucket of cold water.
So, the Rolex 24 at Daytona happened, and I'll give you a brief summary. Porsche Penske Motorsport, they are again. We talked about them. They won for the third consecutive year with Felipe Nasr at the helm. It's a number 7 Porsche 963 of Felipe Nasr, Julian Andlauer, and Lauren Heinrich, winning its third in a row in a race that, as many Rolex 24s do, boil down to a sprint to the finish. It's Nasr in the 7 Porsche versus Jack Aitken in the number 31 Whelen Cadillac. That battle was decided by only 1.5 seconds after 24 hours of running, 17-ish hours of racing because of a big mid-race fog delay. Porsche wins. The 31 Cadillac of Aitken, Earl Bamber, Frederick Vesti, and Connor Zilich finishes second. And the number 24 WRT BMW, Sheldon Vanderlinde, Dries Van Tor, Robin Frins, Renny Rast, rounded off the podium in a solid third in GTP. But both the Porsche Penske cars had a stranglehold on this race, leading 75% of the laps, including all the ones run under big caution. The Sitz car was running well, even with long-running side pod damage they took early on in the race, but ultimately, due to the damage getting worse in the final hour, they slipped down to fourth place. That's Lawrence Van Thor, Kevin Estra, and Matt Campbell. The race had a 6.5 hour long safety car period through the night due to heavy fog and limited visibility at night. It was a surprise that they got it running again at 7:20 in the morning when the fog advisory for the area wasn't going to lift till 9. It was still really sketchy when they first started, but at the end of the race, it's like it never even fogged. The conditions were absolutely perfect. I mean, where do we want to start in the main event of things? Because Felipe Nasr, I mean, we got to talk about him now as like one of the greatest endurance racers of this generation, with 3 Daytona wins, with a Sebring win, with an IMSA championship in this era.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's made pretty good on that 2019 race losing mistake off into turn one in the torrential rain. He has repaid that in kind. It was pretty much Porsche belt to ass from lap one for a fair portion of this race. The 7 gets into second, immediately makes an attack for the lead as the tech bros went digital. The dentists went digital off into turn one and wadded up 4 LMP2 cars at once.
So in plain English, what he's saying here is that Felipe Nasr on the opening lap of the race charges from third to first. Meanwhile, there's a big old LMP2 wreck. Naveen Rao Vera Motorsports sended up the inside of turn one, collects TDS Racing's Toby Luca and CrowdStrike by APR's George Kurtz. And as Luca and United Autosports Phil Fayer are trying to rejoin the race, Luca T-bone crashes into Fayer, taking both cars out of contention. And just like that, my LMP2 race is in the garbage. We'll get to that in a second, because from that opening lap onwards, Cam, as you said, Porsche had this race to stranglehold. They had this race in a stranglehold since the start of practice. They had this race in a stranglehold since the start of the roar before the 24. They were clearly the quickest cars. Fair enough. They made the most of it.
Yeah, I mean, a fair amount of this race was just the two Porsches stunting on everybody, especially during the night, because that car was beyond cracked on the double stint. They had better tire wear than everyone, and they could pretty much run at maximum pace at all times. At least the 7 could. The six car took a clip from the 04 LMP2 coming out of the pits to start the second hour, punched a big old hole in the side pod, big old hole in the floor. And they were fast, but they could never quite keep up with the seven for most of the race. Mm. And one of the effects that had was actually burning more fuel, where the seven could just save a couple percent more pretty much every stint. That added up over time. The six had a strategic blunder relatively late in the race that put them just more in the dirty air behind a couple other cars. The seven was just chopping wood all race.
I was sat back watching that night stint, and Lauren Heinrich was one of the probably the star of this race. That night shift stint to just take control of the race and pull out like an 8, 9, 10 second lead on the competition was incredible driving for a man in the first ever race in that car. Remarkable stuff.
Second. Because remember, he first did Bahrain, but it's his first race in IMSA in this class. And to think, it was only just a little under 3 years ago that all anybody knew Lauren Heinrich for was being that jerk that wrecked the Dacia at the 24 hours of the Nürburgring because he misjudged the speed difference. Oh, how things change after winning an IMSA GTP title, after winning Sebring in class, after being one of the faces of the series, you know.
Like,
he was ready for this. I didn't think he'd be this good off the bat.
Our B-pillar champion. He was the fastest driver on average across this race, ahead of some guy named Pelu, whoever that is.
Pelu.
Depends on who you ask on Radio Le Mans, I suppose. God bless them, but yes.
Lauren Heinrich, man. As an early Lauren Heinrich investor, this was incredibly vindicating. He was better than I ever could have hoped in his first race in that car. Felipe Nasr is the clutchest man alive. He took the car for the final stint. Second highest usage rate of anybody in the GTP field at 293 laps. And he made all of them count. And Julian Andlauer, it's like he was back at Spa running through Eau Rouge and Roussillon again, just every single lap.
Again. His first actual start with the factory team, because remember, he was supposed to do Petit Le Mans, and then his back hurt really bad the morning of the race, and so Lawrence Vanthoor had to drive both cars at Petit Le Mans to close out the season. And Andlauer and Heinrich, both examples of the Porsche ladder system, up from one makes to customer GT racing, all the way up to factory team. It is a damn shame that Heinrich only gets to drive three races in this.
Yeah, that was, for me, the most impressive individual performance of the entire race. Lauren Heinrich doing that at night was just unbelievable stuff. And again, a lot of times, once you look at the sheets, backed it all up. His nighttime running was just sensational. Some of these dudes have got 20 starts.
It's Nasr that closes it out, though, against Jack Aitken, who has taken a lot of grief for the mistakes that he's made early in his GTP career, but coming out of this previous season with back-to-back wins at India Petit Le Mans, getting the double WEC IMSA contract for Cadillac Racing, and closing in at the very end. And keep in mind, this Wieland Cadillac had to overcome a one-lap penalty because, unfortunately, one of Conor Zilich's last acts in his first GTP race was accidentally running the red light at the exit of pit lane, which put them down a lap. They fight
not
back
just
from
that. They also were kicked from qualifying. And they had an early race penalty as well for, I believe it was either jumping the restart at the very start of the race. The 31 went through it. I will say the BOP for a lot of this race looked really quite terrible. I'm like, oh, this is how it feels to be a Ferrari at Le Mans. For like the first 20 hours of the race. And then when the chips were down and the double stint was not a factor, the 7, the 31, and the 24 BMW all were pretty much just right with one another on raw lap time.
Yeah.
I do think the 93 Acura would have been a factor there. And Alex Palou is just him. He was the second on the B pillar. He was the fastest driver in that car. And this is him just trying it out as a hobby.
He's so fucking good.
He's honestly so good.
He's so good. He shouldn't owe Zach Brown a dime, but that's neither here nor there. Ota was good. Yelly was good. Vander Zander was good. Vander Zander looked demoralized early on in that race. That's his words, not mine.
Well, and the problem for the Acura was their tire wear on the double stint. The 963 on raw lap time was probably just a touch ahead of everyone until the end of the first stint, and then it would not stop during the double stint. Just as well, the 93 Acura had a tricycle moment during the night, caused some floor damage, and they were never in the fight again.
Yeah, losing a wheel just before the big reset, putting them a lap down, that really hurt their chances of contending late on in the race.
Yeah. Other than that, if you took the under on middle fingers out the window of a Corvette, you win.
Which is incredible because a Corvette did get shoved off the road. Yeah. GTD Pro was a race that I feel should have gone to Corvette racing if this was entirely decided off of pace and nothing else, because the two factory Corvettes, the works Corvettes, the Millennium Yellow Corvettes were the class of the field for most of this race. But the three car, my pick, broke a right rear suspension while in position to win the race. And the number four car gets shoved off the road at the West Horseshoe by James Collado of Triarsi Competizione. Collado gets a penalty. Of course, he doesn't understand why he got the penalty, because he probably doesn't think he did anything wrong. And that ruins the number four Corvette's race, which turns GTD Pro up in the air. And it's Paul Miller Racing that takes advantage, because on their penultimate pit stop, they decide, you know what? I don't think we're going to make this on energy. So let's run a short stint, give us less fuel to put in the car, and give us new tires to take to the end of our final pit stop. They undercut everybody else. They run qualifying laps. Dan Harper was exceptional down the stretch, as he almost usually is. Golly. What do they do with these drivers in Northern Ireland? And he drives Paul Miller Racing to the front after, remember, they also took a penalty after qualifying. Too much camber at the rear. You can't do that. They get tossed to the rear of the field. And remember, this is the team that was getting the middle fingers from Corvette fans all last year. And after all of that, they drive a clean, penalty-free race to win.
And they needed every single ounce of that, you know, basically qualifying run to the end, because Mauro Engel was turning back the clock in the Sun Energy Mercedes. He was
Express Energy Mercedes, of course.
He was unbelievable down the stretch of that race. The number 911 Porsche, Dre and I picked the Manti Porsche. No, did not work out that way. However, both Ricardo Feller and Thomas Preining did their best. With the straight line speed that car had, I have no idea how those two kept it as high as they did.
It was a very impressive first race in IMSA for Manti. Looks like the Manti you expect out of other series.
Half of this race, you wouldn't have had a hope in hell that Manti would do anything, and they forced themselves into the narrative, even if they couldn't finally pull off the win.
Ressi probably could have had Harry King not triple jump the start, Olympic long jump the start. Look, Harry King's good, but that was
not even close.
That was not good. That was not great. Nick Tandy also was beefing with people. For the second year in a row, Rexy broke his jaw. I needed to go get it swapped out in the pits.
How about 75 Express, though? And how about the other Windward Racing car? Because Mercedes-AMG had this interesting strategy of, we're going to put bronze drivers in our GTD Pro lineup, which is very weird, champ. But the fog delay made it work so that they didn't have to do a whole lot of, like, high leverage. No leverage driving behind the safety car was the best that they could have hoped for. And it worked.
Mild interruption. The clash will now be Wednesday.
Oh, as you do. Midweek. The snow down there must be apocalyptic. Good Lord.
Oh, yeah. 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 Like, you know how people get down with snow.
Oh, yeah.
In the southeastern United States. Even a little bit is snowmageddon, dog.
Even a little bit. Yeah. Like, GTD Pro ended up being really... Like, while GTP was not that exciting until the last couple hours of the race because the Porsches just had a stranglehold up front, GTD Pro was pretty much excitement all the way down.
Yeah.
I will say, I am glad I didn't pick my original pick, which was going to be the 64 Mustang, because that car kicked cylinder number 5 from the chat with a couple hours to go, threw a rod through the side of the block, big boom, big trail of oil on the banking.
Yeah, very, very strange race.
The found on road dead.
The Mustang GT3 Evo did have a tough race on debut, but not for the reasons you might have thought. Because the cars were quick, it's just that only one of the four that were entered across the two GT classes even finished in the race. This is a good segue to GTD. War!
It's war.
Philip Ellis of Windward Racing, Nikki Team of Magnus Racing, just locking horns for the last, I don't know, 30 minutes of the race?
It was like a more vicious version of what we saw with the Corvettes a decade ago at this race, where there was no order not to kill the other car. Instead, we just had Philip Ellis and Nikki Team just beating the snot out of each other for a Rolex.
Including a completely terrifying side draft attempt from Ellis up the tri-oval that went very wrong, and Ellis nearly dumps the front end of his car at 180 miles an hour and somehow saved it.
He was on full opposite lock through the tri-oval.
Not just saved it full opposite lock, but recovers and passes Team up the inside to take the lead of the race, which he ultimately never relinquishes. Team puts a fender to his back. That's as close as he got the rest of the way. He draws alongside into turn one. That's as close as he gets. So Wayward Racing's number 57 car, Philip Ellis, Russell Ward, Indy Dacia, Lucas Auer, that team wins GTD for the third time in six years. Magnus Racing to get second on a limited schedule when this team was supposed to be done after last year's Rolex 24, this team ain't done. Not by a long shot.
Everyone involved was about to be done because that was about to look like a Ryan Newman crash through the infield.
Oh, terrifying.
Which somehow was like the third most brutal Ryan Newman wreck on the sands of Daytona Beach. Just absolute cinema to finish the race. And I don't know how Philip Ellis saved that. I guess he's a Mark Marquez fan because he turned that almost crash into a repass at turn one.
Yeah. Jeez. Like, I was just setting up my braking line for turn one, of course, innit? Well, like what could you ask for?
We're not for turn of motorsport. This looked like the year they finally win it. But late in the race, Robbie Foley, while battling for third with Matt Bell of 13 Autosport, turns Bell, gets a penalty. And because of a second pit work infringement right after serving that penalty, double drive through takes them out of contention. That was my pick as well. This is why I report. I don't have like a sponsored DraftKings segment or anything to tell you how to lose money by making predictions that inevitably go sideways.
Mm.
And then there's LMP2, where somehow one of the cars that got caught up in the lap one, turn one nonsense went on a win. It's Algar Pro Racing. It's George Kurtz's CrowdStrike Racing. After finishing second two of the last 3 years, finally wins it.
Fucking good
that
for
that car was backwards after turn one. 24 hours is a long race, and they made the most of that. Alex Quinn.
Peugeot development driver. Signed this year after some impressive runs of the European and Asian Le Mans series. I can tell you, you will likely see that young man in a factory prototype within the next 12 to 24 months.
stop.
Wouldn't shock me. Yeah. I think he was one of the stars of the show in LMP2.
Yeah.
Very sad because Spike led so much of this race in his new gold suit.
Uh-huh.
I think they had an issue on the car that they found at some point, and that was never quite the same.
Yeah.
I think they ended up finishing fifth down the stretch with Dane Cameron at the helm.
Uh-huh.
Other odds and ends throughout this field. The Wayne Taylor difference of actually not looking too bad for a fair portion of this race. And then the 40 car has a mechanical issue, which ruins the balance of the car at halfway. Right, and the 10 bar. Car came down with a mild case of explosions.
I'm not willing to write the team completely off just yet to start the season, because a lot can happen at Daytona. A lot can happen at Sebring. They could bounce back, but it is just infuriating how this team has fallen so far after switching manufacturers when you don't assume that their drivers are just not up to scratch. And it's not like the team's broke.
No, they're not broke. They
have the drivers.
And they have full factory backing from Cadillac, as all of these cars do, because they don't really select between their teams. Pace-wise, they were not bad for a fair portion of this race. But again, the 40 was crippled by something on the back of the car Taylor was talking about. And it's never a good sign with the 10 when the smoke and fire is pouring out of both the top of the engine and the bottom.
No.
And I think WRT. I'd still take how that went.
Yeah.
Over how it went for the Aston Martin Valkyrie.
Bless them. They got to the finish, but like at Le Mans, they did have some issues getting to the flag. The car shot off multiple times on Saturday night. They had a steering issue on Sunday that threatened to take them out of the race. They were able to patch it back up and finish, although several laps down. That's tough.
For me, it's not even the reliability side of the equation. IMSA very deliberately with this race kind of pulled everyone back together on the balance of performance table because everyone bought upgrades besides Aston Martin. Every one of these cars had an Evo Joker, as we talked about on our pre-race show.
Mm-hmm.
And on a less balance of performance affected table, Aston Martin was getting taken to Gappelby's by the entire LMDH contingent. All of them. They were on average, they were over a second off the pace of the Porsches. On average, they were well over half a second off the next car in the set, which was last year's Porsche run by JDC Miller.
And what doesn't help is when you lose an entire day of the Roar Before the 24 due to an electrical issue that can only be fixed by taking the entire rear end of the car out in a repeat of what happened in the November IMSA sanction test at this circuit. So they're down on testing time at this track going into this race. The pace is not good and the reliability flare-ups. This is a car that finished Le Mans and Sebring, two very tough races, with less trouble than this.
Fortunately, when you have an electrical issue, I mean, that's going to hit at any time and it can affect any car. Fortunately, it affected this one. This, the one non-electrified powertrain as well, ironically. But for me, it's just the pace of the Aston was really, really poor.
That's a good first stanza. It's third place. But you take those if you're a new team that's just renting out space in the Haas F1 team building. You take that.
Yeah, Dries Van Tor is box office. If nothing else, he is as box office as they come. He was superb down the stretch. Just too big a mountain to overcome with the 7 and the 31 chasing each other, because he was pretty much keeping pace with them. There was a couple laps. A friend of the show, Sasha, was following the lap times on that car. They were all within about half a tenth of one another, multiple laps on that final stint. If I were to say one big piece about the winning car, I've maintained this ever since 2015 when he debuted for Sauber and got fifth in a car that we found out was not very good as that season went on.
Mm-hmm.
I really do think Formula One missed out on Felipe Nasr.
I do too.
Yeah. He is superb.
There's a lot of people.
It's sad that beyond his first ever race in F1, where he finished in the top five in a very underfunded Sauber team that had his chief sponsor on the side of the car at the time, that the most other prolific part of Naz's F1 career was David Croft intentionally calling him Fred as a wind-up because he didn't want to confuse him with Felipe Massa. It was stupid then, and it's even more stupid now. He's an incredible fucking racing driver and the best sports car driver on the planet, quite frankly. He's just fast in all phases, in all conditions, and he is an anchor. I mean that in a positive sense. He's the anchor of and captain of an incredible crew, and he's made it work time and time again. Just superb work.
It was the multiple contract season where everybody thought they would have Sauber would have been so much better with Adrian Sutil and Guido Vandergaard. And no, they wouldn't, because neither of them are capable of this. Neither of them would have won three straight Rolex 24s, a feat that only two other people have done.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is that the final act of his F1 career was putting up the points that would kill his future team.
But that's the thing. You never go into a Formula One race tanking your own prospects. You never go out there like tanking not to get the points. Yeah, I understand like, what he did. It's just bad timing.
He put those points up in at the end of 2016, a very poor Sauber, in the literal and figurative sense. In torrential rain in Brazil that race, as we all know, as we were all watching the Max Verstappen arrival race up at the front of the field. He is so damn good. There is no one else I would rather have in my car at the end of a 24-hour race to bring home the win. And once again, and Jack Aitken, bless his heart, he tried. He tried to throw it up the inside of turn David, one, and Nasser put that... put his car more or less in a, if you go for this crash, we're both going to die position.
I saw people saying that Aitken should have dumped in turn one.
All that would have done was earn him a fat penalty and losing the race a different
way. People are still hurt about Ricky Taylor dumping Felipe Albuquerque at the same corner a few years back. And now they're co-drivers.
Funny that.
So I guess I don't think this was race of the year. Unfortunately, that's not in anything in the race's control. When you lose 6.5 hours due to safety car period and the race really boils down to what happens afterwards, it's tough. But
Shane, if you judge it on the last like 5 hours of the race,
you could
probably make an argument, but the rest does matter. And the rest of it in GTP, unfortunately for everyone else, Porsche made that a little bit of a waste of time to watch.
Remember, it's a matter of fairness. IMSA will be back in March at the 12 hours of Sebring. World Endurance Championship will be back in February. We got news that Porsche wants to be back before the end of the decade. Honda might be back as soon as next year. And Alpine might be leaving. Out.
They give an Orica and they take an Orica away.
The Alpine one is particularly sad because, again, we've talked about it before on this show. Bruno Famin kind of stepped down from running the F1 team to try and save the people of Viri. He did the honorable thing to look after his team and look after his people there. And the rest of us all kind of saw the writing on the wall anyway in regards to them giving up their factory status as an F1 team to focus on this. This was meant to be the other project. This is what they were meant to be focusing on. And I think it just fundamentally boils down to Renault being unserious and they don't give a shit about motorsport now.
Yeah, and this other CEO is a vehemently anti-motorsport. And I mean, like, because I have a source elsewhere that is very, very close boots on the ground near Viri. And he said, let me check with my sources. And about 40 minutes later, he goes, fuck.
Yeah.
In that same chat, which, I mean, again, that is an engine factory with many world championships to their credit. Not that many recently. And this Alpine started coming good at the end of last year.
Just won at Fuji. Right. They're bringing different guys, bringing DaCosta back into the fold of endurance racing, bringing Victor Martins in. He finally gets a break. And then this is what happens, man. It's sad.
I don't want them to leave. And again, it's a thing of like the form book doesn't always tell you who's going to be the first to dip.
I mean, Porsche won a World Endurance Championship in 2024. They're not
and
there
now
anymore.
They're just like, and now they're just like, actually, we want to come back. Yeah, we're not pulling the plug on Porsche Penske after this year. We're renewing. You up?
To be, I mean, in fairness, I never thought that they were going to kill off the IMSA program because you wouldn't have known it watching the first 20 hours of this race. But let's just say even the manual shift on the BOP last year was not as severe as the swings that were happening every race in WEC.
And yeah, well, I mean, it's a shame. It's a real shame. Because like I said, the Alpine had been the genuine positive side of the brand in the World Endurance Championship. They were genuinely taking big steps forward last year, turning themselves, they were podium sitters. Yeah,
at race winner.
And then race winning in Fuji, the 100th WEC race as we knew it. Just a shame, man. Like, it's safe to say at this point, with all the shuffling and the chopping and changing, the golden era is over that so many people wanted to make out that this was going to be with Hypercar. Because just as many
but
people
no, it's want not,
to come
because
in.
We have Ford and McLaren coming in. We have Honda coming in potentially next year. Porsche wants to be back. We'll have double-digit manufacturer on the grid. The ACO is now going to have to think about seriously expanding.
At some point, you can be of both minds about it and have a legitimate point. At some point, people are going to want the rules changed to see how they see fit, as always happens in sports car racing.
Mm-hmm.
And people are going to make decisions that make some people really happy and some people really unhappy. And we're already about to see our third manufacturer leave WEC. One of those might come back. One of those is saying in the media that they're going to come back. I'll believe it when I see it with the Lamborghini SC63. It's a golden era, but it kind of feels like it's built atop a deck of cards.
Everything is, though, when you have the economy in the state that it's in. We are in a recession. This would happen under any rule set. The good thing is there are enough people involved to where if one manufacturer drops off, there are now two, at least two, if not three, if not more, that are ready to come right in. You could not say that at the end of the LMP1 golden age.
Well, no, we couldn't say that because Volkswagen Group was whipping $500 million a year between their two programs at a series.
That's
and
funny.
That just ain't going to fly. No, I have reasons to be optimistic and I have reasons to be concerned. I just think they need to nuke the entire BOP system and start over in WEC. Maybe I just go back to the 2024 system.
Quite possibly. Before we get out of here, gents, what do you make of the Honda situation? Because it looks like they might be tying up with Interpol for a potential serious WEC run in 2027.
That's fascinating to me because a few years ago, you wouldn't think Interpol is a serious candidate to run a factory hypercar program.
Why is
but
that?
A lot changes when you change, when you win two Le Mans in 3 years, when you win an IMSA title. They come from a non-traditional motorsport country, and you just think of them as a comedy sideshow team. But now, genuinely, they're one of the best in their category. Their cars just
now. Why are they unconventional, RJ?
Because they are Polish.
They are a Polish bakery.
Yeah, that is their primary line of business. But they have a racing team now that is genuinely one of the best in their field, and yeah, if they are willing to chip in enough to where Honda says this is the right partnership to finally bring us into WEC. And remember, they've also redone the homologation process for the hypercars to where it all goes into one place, one centralized wind tunnel for both series. Suddenly, this makes a lot more sense. And it opens up big opportunities for drivers to spread their wings a little bit.
It does open up the opportunities. I'll believe it when I see it regarding Honda actually fully backing this. I want them to. I want to see the Hondas over there. I think it's silly that the Hondas might only be coming over when the first 2 years was probably the strongest car in the rule set over an IMSA, even ignoring the tire pressure controversy at the 23 Daytona. The concern would be that they would come over here and more or less be funding it out of their own pocket without Honda's involvement. And that just feels like a recipe to be really interestingly painted back markers.
Could very well be the case. We'll have to wait and see.
It looks like it is going to be a matter of when, not if, that is announced.
I think if you want to be competitive, if they want to be competitive in WEC, it's got to be same type of contract they have with MSR, where they are directly involved with the running of the cars.
You
can't, no half measures, not against entities like Ferrari, like Toyota, like the artist formerly known as Porsche Penske Motorsport.
Well, there was an interesting quote that Koji Watanabe made when announcing Super GT lineups, one of which included an HRC engineered car for Autobac's racing team, Aguri. And he said that this will set the template for future four-wheeled factory motorsports programs down the line. And that made me think, well, they're already in IMSA like this, already in Super GT like this now. I can't imagine this is Formula One. I can't imagine this is IndyCar. I can't imagine this is NASCAR. Kind of narrows it down a little bit, don't you think?
So I just want to see Alex Palou back at Le Mans.
Certainly something to chew on when we get out of here.
I want to see somebody cover Alex Palou's legal fees.
Don't worry, Chip's got that covered. More on that in our IndyCar season preview in a couple of weeks' time. As mentioned, it's going to take a couple of weeks out. Wait for the testing to settle itself down, and then we'll be back with season preview season in the middle of February going into March, and, well, the big stuff really kicks off at that point. So Formula One, MotoGP, and IndyCar season previews in about a couple of weeks' time, all through the back end of February and going into early March, when both MotoGP and IndyCar seasons get going in Thailand and St. Petersburg on March 1st, respectively. Until then, though, I've been Jay Harrison. They've been RJ O'Connell and Cameron Buckley. We'll see you in a couple of weeks' time. Until then, thanks for listening. Sayonara.
Later, y'all.
Yeah, fuck Donald Trump.
Real.